conversation.
You're with Kate Talk. One of the highlights of the Franschhoek Literary Festival for me was having the opportunity to host author Lionel Shriver on a panel with Imran Kavadia, talking about the role of fiction in the modern world. She is, of course, an award-winning novelist, born in the US but lives these days in the UK. Her seventh book, We Need to Talk About Kevin, won the Orange Prize. It earned her international acclaim. It was an absolute game changer in terms of her writing career. She's also a widely published non-fiction writer. Her columns and op-eds often very controversial. She has earned her fair share of critics as well as fans over the years. And a little bit earlier this week, I got to sit down with her again to talk about her most recent novel, Should We Stay or Should We Go? It centers around a married couple who make a suicide pact while they're still in their 50s and in good health. Kay and Cyril Wilkinson agree that when they reach the age of 80, they will take their own lives and shuffle off their mortal coil. And as the book unfolds, what she does is, over 12 or so chapters, contemplate different possible outcomes for that story. What happens if one partner changes their mind? What happens if they miss the opportunity to do it and one of them has a stroke or gets dementia beforehand? What if, what if, what if? It is a really interesting book, and it is a lot funnier than you might think given the subject matter. Let's take a listen to that interview. Lionel, the characters in the book are moved to contemplate the possibility of a suicide pact because of the experience they've had watching their own parents age and deal with all the indignity that goes with that, particularly the descent into dementia. I'm curious, have you had any personal experience of that kind that perhaps influenced you to write this book?
Yes, as many of my readers would have. My parents lived to quite a ripe old age, and especially in my mother's case, not in the best of shape. That's an understatement. And it was very painful to watch her become not my mother. You know, I didn't recognize her anymore, and therefore, they both died last year, but especially when my mother died, it was a weird non-event. And that's very embarrassing with yourself. This is not a social thing. It's like, what's wrong with you? Why are you not in mourning? And it's because she had died for me many years before.
I mean, you have your character Kay express that sense, and it's I've often heard dementia described as the slow death that cheats you of the grieving process, as you've just mentioned. I mean, on paper, Lionel, it would seem like a very morbid subject to write about, but this is a book that, I mean, I laughed the whole way through. There are elements of very, very dark humor, which I really enjoyed, and some of the chapters are very playful, as you sort of play in almost in the science fiction space, the futuristic, what if.
Not even almost. It
yeah.
is.
Yeah. I mean, others are, of the chapters are more serious, more philosophical. One partner contemplating what would they miss if they went through with this, or are they going to be able to go through with it at all? It's not something any of us like to dwell on and think about too hard, but really you're asking the reader to think about the question of what makes life valuable and worth living. And the corollary of that being, is life worth living just for its own sake if those valuable things are stripped away from you? Is it something you feel like you have an answer to for yourself?
Oh, there is no answer. In fact, that's the nature of fiction. It asks questions. It does not give you answers. If it does give you answers, there's something wrong with it. You know, that's what we call a polemical novel or a bossy novel. And, you know, when I finished this book, I didn't feel any better of an understanding of the dilemma that it poses, than I did it when I started. In some ways, I had more questions. I think the only thing that I took out of it, once I finished, was a better appreciation for the compromises we are willing to make, and, if I may be more honest, I am probably willing to make, in order to stick around, because the alternative is so, well, unknowable for one thing, but to the degree that it is probably knowable, it's not so great. So, I mean, it's the great nothingness, and, because I'm not especially religious. So, I realized, oh, you know, you think you wouldn't put up with a world in which you didn't have the good health to play tennis anymore. And then I ended up telling myself, well, you know, you're kidding yourself. You'd put up with not being able to play tennis. You might be able to put up with not being able to walk. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe you could even put up with hanging about in bed and reading all day. Sounds kind of nice.
But what about not being able to write? I mean, many of these chapters allow the exploration of the mental decline as well as the physical decline. And, I mean, as somebody whose whole life has been lived around playing with words and working as a writer, is that something you've contemplated? If the point comes where I can't do that anymore, that is a life that I no longer want?
The fact that I don't contemplate it is a giveaway that it frightens me, right? Because I'm aversive of just even contemplating that situation. And, you know, there are particular circumstances that not just I, but most people are primarily afraid of. And one of them, as you point out, is mental decline, and therefore losing a sense of yourself, being a stranger to yourself. So that's going beyond not being able to do things like tennis or writing, but it's a profound loss of self, and for good reason. I think we're all petrified of that. I think we have a reasonable fear as well of being in extreme pain, and I haven't experienced it very often. Once in particular, I went through about 5 days of being in the kind of pain that if that were a condition of my existence, I would seriously consider cutting out. There is a level of agony beyond which life is genuinely not worth living. It costs too much. It destroys everything you love. It becomes impossible to enjoy anything. And you will do almost anything to get out of it. So, and I'm very sympathetic with that. And I think that that's where these assisted suicide laws, that's most of all what they're good for. Not for people who are emotionally miserable. Like most books about death, this is really a book about life.
Yeah.
And, I can see why readers might be a little turned off, reading a book about a suicide pact. To begin with, and I have encountered people who say, I don't want to read about that. But it's a very playful book. Yeah. The parallel universe structure means that even if you lose one or even both characters in the last chapter, they're back again. So yeah. You know, there's a way in which it doesn't take any kind of death very seriously, and it's playful. I think philosophically as well, because it's asking the question, okay, well, you know, in that circumstance, you have to decide whether to go through with a vow you made a long time ago. You are 80 years old. What might you miss out on if you called it quits early? And what might you escape? And of course, I think I am rightly considered a dark, if funny, novelist. It's the what might you escape that especially gets my imagination going. And one of the most interesting chapters for me, for example, is the one in which they give the pact a miss and they live to beyond 100. And that means that they live in long enough to watch the fall of Western civilization. They're still in London, but through a combination of mass immigration from the South and as well of a violent anarchistic homegrown movement, which is busy, you know, burning down Parliament and ripping up all the paintings in the National Gallery. I mean, I went to town.
Yeah, you took it the whole way. Yeah.
And, you know, it's asking a serious question, which is, okay, let's say this is what's in the future. Full stop. Do you want to live to see it or not? And that's a question that I have trouble answering on my own account, because that's not a vision that, I mean, it was really fun to put together on paper, because that's one of the great things about fiction. You can do all kinds of horrible things and then go have a glass of wine.
Without the consequences thereof, yeah.
But, you know, if that's in the future, would I want to see it? I mean, I have a certain narrative curiosity which extends to reality, not just fiction. Mm-hmm. And something in me would still want to see it, because if it is going to happen, then I want to finish the story.
Yeah.
On the other hand, that sounds very, very painful. And something in me would want to duck it. Mm. It's like, okay, maybe that's what's going to happen, but I could stand skipping that. I could go out in a state of naivete. Mm.
And comfortable familiarity.
Right, mm. Right. So I find that, you know, that's the kind of question that this book asks as lightly as possible.
Yeah. It is a book that was influenced by the pandemic. I mean, a very pertinent topic to be thinking about the value of life when we are facing massively consequential decisions about whose lives need to be protected at the cost of what. The last 2 years, decisions have been made about what length society goes to protect those who are at risk, when it places others at risk who weren't at risk in the first place. And there's a lot of that churning through everybody's thoughts, I think. How much did the pandemic influence your writing of this book?
Not powerfully. I mean, oddly, there's this single date in the book which is pivotal, and I knew that setting out, and so I had to decide when that was. And that's when the wife turns 80.
Yeah.
And that means they're both 80, and it's time to execute the pact if they're going to go through with it. And because I wanted the book to be as contemporary as possible, I started the book on Boxing Day in 2019, and I said, well, let's set that date just a little bit in the future that hasn't happened yet. So I chose the 29th of March, 2020. And I asked myself, well, what could happen?
What could the world possibly look like there?
And then, of course, you know, I'm well into the manuscript by the time March hits, and whoom, big surprise for me. I read the newspaper enough to have not been that naive about what can happen in three months. And I faced the questions that, you know, I could change the date, I could change the year, or I could incorporate it into the story.
Lionel, Kay and Cyril in this book are not just contemplating what parts of their lives they value and where that line lies at which it's no longer meaningful and valuable to hold on to life, but they're also thinking about what the rest of society values about them, or rather your possibilities that you explore reveal a lot about how society values them and what would it be like for them to become an afterthought, to be sidelined, to be not seen as somebody of value anymore. And for Cyril in particular, there's a sense of some hubris about that.
Indeed.
Is it something that you fear, the point at which Lionel Shriver, the famously argumentative and controversial and talented writer who's often shouted at but always talked about, is no longer somebody who occupies the conversation?
Oh, I think that is one of the great challenges of old age, which I have not quite entered, but it's waiting for me. And it requires a great deal of grace and graciousness and humility. None of these qualities come to me easily. And I'm sure to go out kicking and screaming.
She won't go out unnoticed, that's for sure. Lionel Shriver, the author of Should We Stay or Should We Go? If you'd like to get your hands on a copy, it is available in all good bookstores, retailing at around about 360 Rand a copy.